It's amazing how persistent the idea of life energy is, even in our modern world. If you were trying to make sense of the world thousands of years ago, prior to any modern scientific knowledge, it makes sense that you would assume there is some fundamental difference between living and non-living things. Living things are active. They appear to have agency. They can use energy to do stuff, and they could die. Inanimate objects have none of these properties. Our brains are in fact organized to divide the world into these two categories. The animate, which it operationally defines as moving in a way that suggests agency, and inanimate. Our brains assign direct emotional significance to animate things, but not to inanimate things. It's understandable, then, that pretty much every human culture independently developed some version of the belief that a special animating force makes living things alive. The Romans called it spiritus, and the Greeks pneuma, both words also meaning breath. In China, it is called qi, which also translates to blood, because they felt the life force was carried in the blood. In Japan, it is ki, in India, prana, in Polynesia, mana, and in Arabic, it is baraka. The notion that our thoughts, memories, feelings, ambitions, and all our mental functions are the result of the activity of cells in our brains is a very modern concept. Prior to modern neuroscience, even our best thinkers assumed that our minds were something more than physical. How could a clump of matter have feelings? It simply doesn't fit with our intuitions. Interestingly, studies of young children find that their naive reasoning about biology includes the notion of life energy and essence. Further, they think that organs have agency and intentionality, and that they transfer energy as part of their function. This was found in both Japanese and American children, and is therefore not specific to any one culture. Children use the assumption of vitalism until they gain a more scientific understanding of life. Up to the 19th century, the notion of vital energy or essence was a placeholder for a collective ignorance about biology. At no point did we prove necessarily that the vital force doesn't exist. It was simply edged out by scientific explanations. Vitalism became worse than wrong. It was simply unnecessary. It stands as an excellent historical example of how ideas emerge and fade in science, and how important it is to recognize when a scientific notion is supported by evidence, and when it is just a guess we use to explain the unknown. The more we learned about biochemical, physiological, genetic, and neurological functions, the less there was for the vital force to do. Each step of the way, the vital force was retained to explain whatever it was we didn't yet understand, a vitalism of the gaps per se. Eventually, there was simply nothing left for the vital force to do, and by the end of the 19th century, vitalism had simply vanished from scientific thought. The beginning of the end came perhaps with Friedrich Wöhler. Many vitalists argued that organic compounds couldn't be synthesized from inorganic material, because living matter was fundamentally different from non-living matter. But in 1828, Wöhler made urea from inorganic material, definitively disproving this notion. This discovery later gave rise to the myth that vitalism ended when Wöhler made urea, but this isn't supported by history. The tendrils of vitalism continued into the 20th century, but only on the fringes of science. More and more, vitalistic thinking became the arena of pseudoscience and the paranormal. In our modern world, I think it's fair to say vitalism is entirely relegated to these areas. It has morphed into a vague New Age concept, something to do with energy and vibrations. What kind of energy? Don't ask, just energy. In a 2013 study looking at vitalistic thinking in adults, researcher Stuart Wilson found that belief in a vital force corresponded strongly with beliefs in the paranormal and New Age philosophy. Many alternative medicine modalities are explained with hand-waving references to energy or life force. Chiropractic, at least the purest form, still practiced by about 30% of chiropractors, is based upon the so-called innate intelligence, which is their term for the life force. D.D. Palmer, who made up chiropractic, claimed that innate intelligence would descend from heaven into your brain and then down through the spinal cord to the rest of the body. Subtle subluxations or misalignments of the spine cause health problems because they are blocking the flow of innate. I have never heard an explanation for how someone with a spinal cord injury can live at all with such a complete blockage of their innate. Another life energy-based treatment is therapeutic touch, which consists of waving the hands over a person, fluffing up and unblocking their human energy field. Reiki is essentially the same thing, just using the Japanese term. Traditionally, acupuncture is explained as placing needles into special points that represent critical junctures in the flow of qi, unblocking and rebalancing this life force. No one, of course, has been able to demonstrate that anything like life energy exists. There doesn't appear to be any qi, human energy field, or innate. It can't be detected by any instrument. Practitioners cannot demonstrate that they can detect it. There doesn't appear to be anything for the life force to do, and no practice based upon such a notion has been proven to be effective. Now, before you say, but wait, what about Curlian photography? Well, that is just one pseudoscience used to prop up another. It's like saying, I know aliens exist because I can communicate with them telepathically. Curlian photography was made popular by parapsychologist Thelma Moss in her book, The Body Electric, 1979. She thought she had discovered a window into the world of bioenergy that would bring things like acupuncture into the scientific mainstream. However, her techniques led to nothing useful. The images generated by these photographs are simply a manifestation of barometric pressure, moisture, electrical fields, and other known physical phenomena. Despite its continued popularity, the vital life force remains a pre-scientific placeholder displaced by our knowledge of biology. It stands, however, as a good reminder that just because a belief feels right, that doesn't make it real. There is clearly a primal appeal to the notion of life energy, but we can't ignore a couple centuries of biological science that tell us it doesn't exist. But I didn't explain all this to the woman at the conference kiosk. She seemed to have her hands full with a hotel full of skeptics. Historically, our path out of belief in a vital force was mirrored by our path beyond belief in a non-corporeal mind inhabiting our physical bodies. Before modern neuroscience, dualists, like vitalists, had a point, and their position does seem to resonate with how we feel. We all want to believe Yoda when he says, "Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter." It sounds like wisdom. Now we know that the truth is closer to what psychologist Susan Blackmore said. When I say that consciousness is an illusion, I do not mean that consciousness does not exist. I mean that consciousness is not what it appears to be. If it seems to be a continuous stream of rich and detailed experiences happening one after the other to a conscious person, this is the illusion. It has now been well established beyond any scientific doubt that the mind is what the brain does. The functioning of the brain is consciousness. In a sense, we are our brains. We know, for example, that if the brain is not functioning, then you are not conscious. If we put the brain to sleep, you go to sleep. In fact, recent studies have shown that you need about 40% of your cortex to be healthy and active to maintain wakeful consciousness. If more than that is damaged, you will be in a coma or vegetative state. If we change the brain, then we also change the mind. Drugs that alter brain function alter consciousness. You may have experienced this yourself. Different brain states correlate to different states of consciousness. For example, when you're asleep, your brain is still functioning, but in a different way than when you are awake. When you dream, your consciousness is altered in a way that correlates nicely with alterations in brain function. As the brain develops, our mental states also develop. Children are different from adults because their brains are different. We can now use technology to turn different parts of the brain on or off, and the corresponding mental state also turns on or off. We've been able to do this for a long time during brain surgery by stimulating different parts of the brain. Now we can do it less invasively with transcranial magnetic stimulation. And finally, when your brain dies, you die. There is no evidence of any consciousness without brain function or after death. As an aside, Dualists often invoke near-death experiences as evidence for mind separate from body. But near-death experiences do not require such an explanation. They are simply experiences the mind may produce during trauma, or when recovering from trauma or severe stress. If you look at the hypothesis that the brain causes consciousness, and then you make predictions based on that hypothesis, it turns out every one of those predictions is true. To deny this connection is to deny all of modern neuroscience. In that way, modern dualists are neuroscience deniers, in the same exact way that creationists are evolution deniers. They deny the current model of biological neuroscience in order to manufacture a gap, and then they try to slip their dualism, their ghost in the machine, into it. Mind of the gaps. To explain where most dualists go wrong in their logic, let me start with a quote from Jerry Fodor, who stated in a book published in 2001 that, so far, what our cognitive science has found out about the mind is mostly that we don't know how it works. At this point, you may be thinking that we still don't fully understand how the brain works and creates the phenomenon of mind, and you would be correct. But that is a misdirection, confusing the question, does A cause B, with how does A cause B? We can know with a high degree of certainty, based on the lines of evidence I outlined previously, that the brain causes the mind without fully understanding exactly how it does so. Let me illustrate this denial tactic by referring again to creationism, or evolution denial. Evolution deniers will often take quotes from biologists that refer to either the mechanisms of evolution or the details of the historical pattern of evolution and present them as if they are questioning the fact of evolution. For example, one of the classic icons of evolution is the American Museum of Natural History display of the evolution of horses from Eohippus, now tragically renamed Hyracotherium, to the modern horse. As our understanding of the pattern of evolution developed, it was realized that such linear progressive representations are fictions. Evolution with speciation creates a branching bush of descent without any linear trend toward an apparent goal. Cherry-picking horse relatives from this bush and placing them in a line toward one branch, modern horses, completely misrepresents the true pattern of speciation over time in the horse lineage. Creationists still delight in taking quotes to that effect completely out of context, as if they call into question the fact of evolution itself. Debates over the details of evolution don't decrease our confidence that evolution happened, just as research into the details of genetic complexity doesn't call into question the basic facts of genetics, or the fact that DNA is the molecule of inheritance. Science progresses largely by creating a more and more detailed picture of nature, digging deeper and deeper into how the world works. Generally, lower level or more detailed questions don't affect higher level ones, even if they reveal an anomaly that cannot be explained by the overall paradigm. This usually results in a modification of the paradigm, not a dismissal of it. Returning to consciousness and the brain, all the evidence we have suggests that the mind is a product of the brain. The evidence that the brain creates mind is, in my opinion, overwhelming, while the evidence for a mind separate from the body is dubious and questionable, certainly insufficient to disprove the brain-mind hypothesis. Dualists have therefore adopted the strategy of creationists by requiring that neuroscientists explain, in detail, exactly how the brain creates the subjective experience of mind. There are preliminary answers to this question. The mind is an emergent property of the brain and cannot be reduced to any single component of brain function. This is, admittedly, just a partial answer, merely describing the type of phenomenon we are dealing with and not really explaining it. We have also identified many of the components of consciousness, localized them to specific brain regions. For example, we've pinpointed brain regions that create the sense we are inside our bodies, that we exist as an entity separate from the rest of the universe, and that allow us to direct our attention and form memories. We long ago determined those parts of the brain that see, feel, plan, and execute movement, and generate emotional reactions. With functional MRI studies, neuroscience has accelerated and we are quickly reverse engineering the brain piece by piece. This brings up another aspect of the dualist strategy, focusing on a snapshot of a science rather than its progress over time. As mentioned previously, there will always be gaps in our scientific knowledge, and their presence doesn't really tell us anything about the power and success of a scientific explanatory paradigm. A better method of assessment is to look at how it has progressed. Pseudosciences like homeopathy and ESP have not progressed. They're chasing their tails, going around in circles. Evolution, by contrast, has been remarkably successful as a means of scientific explanation. Likewise, the materialist paradigm of mind and consciousness, the notion that the brain is the cause of mind, has been and continues to be a very successful model. One manifestation of this is that neuroscience, as a discipline, has grown and advanced. As new tools come online, our ability to explore the brain and to explain the phenomenon of mind has increased. The dualist paradigm, by contrast, has not produced anything tangible or reliable. The handwriting is on the wall for dualists, just as it was for the creationists. Scientists follow what works. Evolution works as an explanation for the complexity of life on Earth and has vanquished the need to invoke magical creation. Biology works as an explanation for why living things are different from non-living things, and we no longer have to invoke a life force. Neuroscience works as an explanation of mind and consciousness, and we no longer have to invoke a spirit to fill in the gaps. We will never have all the answers, never fill in all the gaps. But as long as these paradigms continue to flourish and succeed, scientists and the scientific community will follow them. And the deniers will be further and further marginalized to griping on the sideline, peevishly pointing at the shrinking gaps, and desperately trying to prop up false anomalies. Cartesian dualists. There are different flavors of dualism. Cartesian dualists, named after René Descartes, believe that consciousness is fundamentally non-physical or spirit in nature and that it communicates with the body through the brain. Humans, therefore, are both physical and spirit. This relates to the second strategy dualists often use to argue for dualism. The first is the mind of the gaps described previously. The second, which is really just an argument from ignorance against neuroscience, is the claim that the mind doesn't have the same properties as physical things and therefore cannot be physical. Here's what they say. Physical things have a location. You can say where your house is. They have size, mass, and shape, the properties of material things. Then the dualists ask, what is the size of an emotion, the shape of a memory, or the mass of your dreams? Consciousness, they argue, doesn't have the properties of material things. Therefore, it is not a material thing. Therefore, it is something else. Let's call it spiritual. This may sound superficially interesting, but it is utter nonsense. They are making what we call a category mistake. They are assuming that consciousness is a thing, and they're wrong. The brain is a thing, and it has all the properties of a thing. The mind is not a thing. It is a process. The mind is not the brain. It is what the brain does. It is the brain in action. Let me give you what may at first seem like a strange analogy, capitalism. Capitalism itself does not have concrete physical properties. There is currency, there are goods, and there are consumers. These are like the brain. They are the physical substrate of an economy. Capitalism, however, is what all of these things do. It only exists when things are happening, when people are spending money on goods or services. We must no more conclude that capitalism is an interaction between the physical and the spiritual than that consciousness is. Light fairies. Another way that dualists attempt to rescue their belief from the avalanche of neuroscientific evidence is to appeal to the correlation is not necessarily causation fallacy. They say, sure, the brain correlates with the mind in all those ways you point out, but that doesn't mean the brain causes the mind. Perhaps, they argue, the brain is simply a receiver for the mind, which lies outside of the physical. If you change the channel on your TV, the TV being the brain in this analogy, that changes the program, but the TV didn't cause the program. This analogy fails, however. I might be able to change the channel, but I cannot change what the actors do on the television show by adjusting the TV. I cannot turn a drama into a comedy. This line of reasoning also violates Occam's razor. I might argue that when you turn on the light switch, a light fairy goes from the switch to the light and activates the light with their own fairy light energy. When you turn off the switch, the fairy returns and the light turns off. The fairy, of course, is invisible, incorporeal, and can travel at the speed of light. There is no way you can prove that my light fairy doesn't exist. Sure, you can argue that opening and closing a circuit correlates with the light turning off and on, but that correlation doesn't prove causation. When the electricity is off, the fairy goes to sleep. Electricity doesn't cause the light, it is just a medium for the fairy. The problem with my fairy hypothesis is not that it's wrong, it's that it's not even wrong. It is simply unnecessary. It is an added supernatural step that is entirely superfluous and doesn't actually explain anything. Saying that the mind is caused by spirit is as unnecessary. Occam slices it away. The hard problem. So how do we explain how the brain causes consciousness, or how brain function is consciousness? We don't yet know all the elements of brain function that are essential for consciousness, or know how they work together, but we are making steady progress. It does seem, however, that every part of the brain contributes its bit to consciousness. There is no, quote, seat of consciousness. Neuroscientists thought there might be one central control center, which they called the global workspace, but recent research has shown this is not the case. Consciousness, therefore, is like a committee. No one person is the committee. Every person contributes. You also need a certain quorum, a minimum number of people, before you have a committee, and you need a certain amount of brain function in order to be awake and conscious. The brain's committee seems to be a bit chaotic, with everyone shouting for attention and talking over one another. They may even fight, but in the end a collective decision is made. In this analogy, the thoughts of the individuals are your subconscious mind. Subconscious basically refers to brain processes that occur below the level of awareness. You can even make decisions without being aware that you did, and act on them before you're aware the decision was made. Some modern dualists, like David Chalmers, acknowledge all these advances in neuroscience, but refer to them as the easy problems. Chalmers argues that we can figure out how the brain moves your arm or sees something or does mathematical calculations. What we can't figure out, however, is the hard problem. Why do you experience your own existence? Chalmers isn't a Cartesian dualist. He's a property dualist. He feels that consciousness is a manifestation of the material world, just a phenomenon currently unknown to science. Chalmers talks about what he calls philosophical zombies, or P-zombies for short. He argues that it's possible to imagine a being that does everything a human does, but is not aware of its own experience. Subjective experiences of things, such as the experience of seeing red, are called qualia. So, Chalmers asks, why are there qualia? The other side of this argument is perhaps best articulated by Daniel Dennett. He says, essentially, that there is no hard problem. It's easy problems all the way down. Once you have solved all the easy problems, then you've solved the hard problem by extension. To explain further, he encourages you to simply ask, and then what happens? The brain sees an image. That information goes to the association cortex, which gives it meaning as a thing. And then that information goes to the amygdala for the assignment of emotion to the thing you are seeing, if it is living. And then what? Well, then that information goes to some other part of the brain where memories are stored. And then what? Well, that provokes a pattern recognition in your memory of a previous event involving the object. And then what? Then that information goes again to the emotional centers to provoke the emotions you have associated with that memory. And the chain keeps going. It never stops. All these components of brain function that we've identified just keep going around in circles. The brain talks to itself. It receives new information. It activates circuits and networks. it provokes other networks, on and on until you die. That endless chain of activity, which pauses when you sleep but is actually replaced by other types of brain activity that just don't produce wakefulness, is your stream of consciousness. It doesn't ever have to go anywhere or report to anything. It's simply consciousness. Therefore, there is no hard problem. We understand consciousness to the degree that we have explained and understand the easy problems. What about Chalmers' P-zombies? That's an interesting question, but I challenge his central premise that qualia are not necessary to do everything we do. While this is a difficult question to answer definitively, here are some possibilities. We know that even the most basic bacteria have a system of attraction and repulsion. They'll swim up a chemical gradient toward food and away from poisons. This is also the most basic function of nervous systems, to provide reward for adaptive behavior and pain for harmful behavior. Pain and reward are the essence of function. For this system to work, however, pain has to feel bad, and reward circuitry has to feel good on some level. As creatures become more sophisticated, their reward and aversion circuitry also become more sophisticated. This evolves into complex emotions. Think, too, about motivation. Fear is a great motivator to get you to focus and marshal all your energy to run really hard away from that predator. Others have speculated that because a memory of an experience is essentially identical in the brain to the experience itself, but organisms need to know if they're remembering something or experiencing it in real time. The two things have to feel different in some way. And finally, there needs to be some mechanism for allocating attention. Our brains cannot pay attention to everything at the same time, nor can they perform every type of processing at the same time. In fact, we exert a significant amount of our mental energy just focusing our attention on the important stuff and filtering out the rest. Attention certainly implies a conscious agent. Even if it's possible to design a system that mimics all these things without actually paying attention or feeling things, that doesn't mean that evolution would not have hit upon qualia as an easy solution. The fact is, we do experience our own existence, and it works. These are all understandably difficult concepts. In a way, it's the brain trying to understand itself, the single most complex thing we know of in the universe. For this reason, we need to be especially careful and especially humble. We can't trust simple reasoning or our naive intuitions. Essentially, I think that dualists are invoking magic to explain why their intuitions can't easily grasp consciousness as a phenomenon. It is quite possible that, because our brains evolved to give us the very useful illusion of a continuous stream of seamless consciousness, we evolved to not easily grasp our own consciousness. That would require piercing the illusion. Science can accomplish understanding consciousness with decades of careful thought and research. Neuroscience is working out pretty damn well. I see no reason to lose our nerve, to start invoking light fairies, and essentially give up trying to scientifically understand one of the greatest puzzles of the universe. Chapter 37. Skeptic's Guide Entry, N-Rays. The story of N-Rays is a classic tale of how bias can affect research, how an appealing fad can take hold, and how a little bit of skepticism can serve as an antidote. The scientific method consists of the use of procedures designed to show not that our predictions and hypotheses are right, but that they might be wrong. Scientific reasoning is useful to anyone in any job because it makes us face the possibility, even the dire reality, that we were mistaken. Carol Tavris. Prosper René Blondlot, 1849 to 1930, was an accomplished French physicist who received three prizes from the Académie des Sciences for his work in electromagnetism. Despite this, he is best known for his role in one of the classic scientific blunders of modern times. In 1895, German scientist Wilhelm Röntgen discovered X-rays, electromagnetic radiation with a wavelength ranging from 0.01 to 10 nanometers. This discovery made Rentgen famous and brought significant prestige to the German physics community. The discovery also created the expectation that other forms of electromagnetic radiation would soon be discovered, and many physicists, including Blondlot, sought to do just that. It was therefore not surprising when, in 1903, Blondlot announced the discovery of another source of radiation that he named N-rays, after his birthplace, Nancy, France, and his university. Between 1903 and 1906, no less than 300 papers on N-rays were published in the scientific literature, involving about 100 scientists and medical researchers. At least 40 scientists claimed to see these N-rays. Blondlot reported that N-rays were produced by many types of matter, both living and inert, everything except green wood and some treated metals, and that their strength increased with the psychic activity of the source. His experimental setup included a hot wire inside an iron tube to generate the N-rays, which were then refracted through a 60-degree angle prism of aluminum, and in turn were detected by a calcium sulfide thread that would glow slightly. The subtle glow could only be perceived in the dark by those with sharp vision. Other researchers discovered much about the properties of N-rays. They could apparently penetrate metal and wood, but were blocked by water. Medical scientists discovered that they were emitted by muscles and the human brain, and hoped they would be as useful in medical diagnosis as X-rays were turning out to be. It was discovered that N-rays could be transmitted over a wire. The science of N-rays was taking off, but there was one slight problem. N-rays do not exist. All of this research was nothing more than self-deception. The first clue that there was something wrong with N-rays came from the fact that English and German physicists couldn't replicate the French research. The laws of physics don't follow national borders, and so this failure to replicate generated considerable skepticism, as it should. Scientific reputations and French pride were on the line. The French physics community would certainly have wanted their own electromagnetic radiation to match the Germans' X-rays, so it was easy for them to tell themselves that the German and English researchers just weren't doing it right. They didn't have the sensitive eye necessary to see the subtle glow of the thread that was the only evidence N-rays existed. N-rays had other curious properties that served only to increase skepticism among non-French physicists. Blondlot claimed that N-rays had a long wavelength, like infrared light, but that they passed through substances that should only admit much shorter wavelengths. N-rays had no direct effect on photographic plates, and so could only be detected through the subjective perception of the researchers, although in some experiments the glowing detector was photographed to document its intensity. Blondlot also found that he continued to detect N-rays even after the source was removed, leading him to conclude that certain substances, such as the quartz lens used in some setups, could store N-rays and later emit them. He even, quote, discovered that the vitreous humor of the human eye could store and emit N-rays. The more Blondlot and his colleagues discovered about N-rays, the more their confidence grew, while the skepticism of German and English scientists grew equally large. To settle this growing dispute, Robert W. Wood of Johns Hopkins University was sent by the journal Nature to observe Blondlot's experimental procedure. Wood had been unable to detect N-rays himself and wanted to see if he could resolve the discrepancy. As he later wrote, "I went, I must confess, in a doubting frame of mind, but with the hope that I might be convinced of the reality of the phenomena, the accounts of which have been read with so much skepticism." Wood was perhaps the perfect person to undertake this investigation. He had a reputation for being a prankster. He was also a science popularizer and took it upon himself to investigate and debunk the pseudoscience of his day. Blondlot and his assistants set up an experiment in which an aluminum prism was used to show the spectrum of N-rays. Blondlot insisted that he was able to see the faint glow of the detector in a completely dark room, while Wood could see nothing. Wood spent hours in Blondlot's lab conducting several experiments to see if the N-rays could be reliably demonstrated. In the first setup, Blondlot and his assistants claimed they could see the glowing thread, while Wood could not. This was explained as Wood not having sufficiently sensitive vision. So Wood did a simple control. The presence of his hand in the pathway of the N-rays should have been enough to block them. So, in the darkened room, he asked his colleagues to view the thread and tell him when his hand was blocking the N-rays. They couldn't reliably do so, stating that the thread was dimming or brightening even when his hand was still. He next observed their attempts to show differences in how the experimental setup changed the brightness of the detector as documented on film. However, he observed that the cathode used to generate the N-rays naturally fluctuated by about 25%, so changes in the light source could explain apparent changes in the brightness of alleged N-rays. There was also the possibility that the precise techniques used by the experimenters, the angle and duration of exposure to the film, could affect the outcome. Finally, Wood performed the control for which he is most famous. In the third experimental setup, an aluminum prism was used to bend the N-rays and spread them out into a spectrum. As he recounted in his eventual letter to Nature detailing his observations, "I was unable to see any change whatever in the brilliancy of the phosphorescent line as I moved it along, and I subsequently found that the removal of the prism, we were in a dark room, did not seem to interfere in any way with the location of the maxima and minima in the deviated ray bundle. I then suggested that an attempt be made to determine by means of the phosphorescent screen whether I had placed the prism with its refracting edge to the right or to the left, but neither the experimenter nor his assistant determined the position correctly in a single case. Three trials were made. This failure was attributed to fatigue." Wood, with a few simple controlled experiments, single-handedly demolished the entire field of N-rays. Lessons from N-rays. The story of N-rays is a classic cautionary tale of pathological science, bias, and self-deception among otherwise accomplished scientists. And yet the story is not nearly as well known as it should be. The French scientists ignored many red flags that should have stoked their own skepticism. In science, it pays to be one's own most vehement critic and greatest skeptic. This means trying earnestly to prove your own hypothesis wrong, and tentatively accepting it only to the degree that it survives dedicated attempts at doing so. Blondlot displayed the opposite of self-skepticism. He too casually proffered ad hoc explanations for the curious aspects of N-rays, such as concluding that only certain people could see them. Even when blinded evaluation failed, the failure was attributed to fatigue, rather than the far simpler explanation that N-rays do not exist. This is why Occam's razor is so valuable to scientific inquiry. We can always invent clever explanations for why our hypothesis appears to fail, but we must take very seriously the straightforward possibility that our hypothesis is simply wrong. History repeats itself. Lest you think this is a quaint example from the turn of the 19th century, not relevant today, the research of Jacques Benveniste will provide a more recent example. In 1988, Benveniste published a paper in Nature magazine claiming that water retains the memory of substances that had been diluted in it, even through extreme dilutions. This research was obviously done in the context of providing a mechanism for homeopathy, which uses fanciful treatments that are diluted often to such an extreme degree that none of the original substance remains beyond background levels. Benveniste's claim was that even when the original substance is gone, the water retains its chemical signature through its own structure. Benveniste's lab worked primarily with antibodies that activated basophils, which are immune cells, causing them to release histamine, which can be detected microscopically. Benveniste was an immunologist by training. He claimed that water that once had antibodies in it could still activate basophils after the antibodies were diluted away. John Maddox, then editor of Nature, published the results even though he was skeptical of their validity because the paper had survived peer review. But, in keeping with the history of his prestigious journal, he went to inspect the experimental procedure for himself. He took along Walter Stewart of the National Institutes of Health, who was an investigator of scientific fraud, and noted skeptic and magician James Randi. Like Wood before them, they published their findings in a follow-up article in Nature, detailing a number of failings of Benveniste's lab. During the investigation, the team did what Wood did. They blinded the evaluation. When properly blinded, the replicated experiments were negative. The only debate among the investigators was whether the original results were due to bias or fraud. It was noted that one co-researcher critical to carrying out the experiments, Elisabeth Davinas, was the only one who could consistently produce positive results. Randi, in his talks on the experience, recounted observing her read a plate, check to see whether or not the sample was a test or a control, and then recount the plate to obtain a number more to her liking. Randi also recalled that she was alone among her team in not being nervous when the results were about to be revealed. He interpreted this to mean that she knew the results, properly blinded, would turn out negative. However, a team of observers representing the journal Nature concluded that unwitting bias, not fraud, on the part of Davinas was a major explanation for the previously reported results. Like Blondlot, Benveniste ignored multiple anomalies in the data that should have prompted skepticism. He further refused to adhere to the blinded results, instead dismissing the investigation as a witch hunt. These historical cases, while perhaps among the most dramatic, aren't unique. More subtle manifestations of self-deception are common, even among mainstream, respected researchers. I routinely encounter rationalizations for why therapeutic trials turn out negative. Perhaps, it is suggested, the dose wasn't high enough, or the treatment duration long enough. Perhaps the treatment would work on a subset of patients, if they could be identified. Perhaps a better outcome measure should be used. It's certainly possible that one or more of these explanations could be true. It is also possible, and a lot more likely, that the treatment simply doesn't work. What makes these explanations unconvincing is their ad hoc nature. Humans in general are great at coming up with reasons to maintain their desired beliefs in the face of contradictory data. More intelligent and educated people aren't necessarily better at critical thinking, but they are likely to be more clever and creative in coming up with such excuses, and scientists are no exception. Chapter 38. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Positive Thinking. The power of positive thinking movement is the cornerstone upon which self-help empires are built. From Chopra to Oprah, self-proclaimed gurus of the movement have made large sums of money via traditional consumer-based strategies, like television programs, books, seminars, and retreats. The underlying rhetoric is simple. If you think positively, positive results will come. The correspondence between reality and my beliefs comes from reality controlling my beliefs, not the other way around. Eliza S. Yudkowsky. Wouldn't it be nice if just imagining something, thinking about it really, really hard, made it come to pass? This is a type of magical thinking that has broad appeal. It gives us the illusion of power and control, but it's just that, magical thinking. It is also what many self-help authors and gurus would have you believe. It falls under many names, mind over matter, the law of attraction, manifestation, magnetism, but all its iterations have one thing in common. Absolutely no scientific evidence backs up such ideas. From Rhonda Byrne's The Secret to Wallace Waddle's The Science of Getting Rich, self-help authors, whether con artists or sincere believers, are cashing in on the power of positive thinking movement. Search any bookseller's website for Law of Attraction, and you'll get thousands of hits for books touting a foolproof scheme to make money, find love, improve your memory, or even cure cancer. And if that worries you, it should. Not only can we not change the universe just by wishing, doing so seems to be counterproductive. Psychologist and friend of the SGU, Richard Wiseman, points out that the research clearly shows no benefit from positive thinking. In fact, there is a negative effect. Wiseman notes that in a 1999 study, Lean Pham and Shelley Taylor compared, quote, effects of process versus outcome-based mental simulations on performance, unquote. In other words, they had students think about getting a good grade on an upcoming exam, outcome-based, compared them to students who thought about the process of studying and taking the exam, process-based, and compared both to a control. The students who imagined the process did better than the control, but the students who imagined getting good grades actually did worse. The lesson is clear. Positive thinking by itself is not only worthless, it's a waste of time and effort that detracts from more practical activity. However, imagining the process you need to go through in order to achieve a goal is useful because it leads to actual action. It's the action, in this case studying, that has the positive outcome. In fact, research shows there are many benefits of a negative or pessimistic outlook. Pessimism correlates with higher earnings, fewer marital problems, more effective communication, greater generosity, and less disappointment. It is apparently helpful to worry, at least to some extent. Excessive optimism can make us careless and set us up for failure. An excessively positive outlook can also complicate dying. Psychologist James Coyne has focused his career on end-of-life attitudes in patients with terminal cancer. He points out that dying in a culture obsessed with positive thinking can have devastating psychological consequences for the person facing death. Dying is difficult. Everyone copes and grieves in different ways. But one thing is for certain. If you think you can will your way out of a terminal illness, you will be faced with profound disappointment. Individuals swept up in the positive thinking movement may delay meaningful evidence-based treatment, or neglect it altogether, instead clinging to so-called manifestation practices in the hope of curing disease. Unfortunately, this approach will most often lead to tragedy. In perhaps one of the largest investigations on the topic to date, Dr. Coyne found that there is simply no relationship between emotional well-being and mortality in the terminally ill. See James Coyne, Howard Tenen, and Adelita Ranker, 2010. Not only will positive thinking do nothing to delay the inevitable, it may make what little time is left more difficult. People die in different ways, and quality of life can be heavily affected by external societal pressures. If an individual feels angry or sad but continues to bear the burden of friends, loved ones, and even medical professionals' expectations to keep up a brave face or stay positive, such tension can significantly diminish quality of life in one's final days. And it's not just the sick and dying who are negatively impacted by positive thinking pseudoscience. By its very design, it preys on the weak, the poor, the needy, the down and out. Preaching a gospel of abundance through mental power sets society as a whole up for failure. Instead of doing the required work or taking stock of the harsh realities we often face, individuals find themselves hoping, wishing, and praying for that love, money, or fame that will likely never come. This, in turn, has the potential to set off a feedback loop of despair and failure. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that being a reasonably positive person is a bad thing. Nor am I advocating that one actively squelch a sunny disposition. But don't expect to think good thoughts and be showered with some sort of cosmic blessing. Unfortunately, the universe doesn't work that way. Chapter 39. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Pyramid Scheme. A pyramid scheme is a type of business that lures in new recruits by promising them an income from those they recruit themselves. Typically, people who engage in these businesses need to spend money to buy products or other materials related to the business. The training they receive is geared toward finding new recruits. If you imagine a pyramid, new recruits must find another bigger layer of recruits below them, and that new layer will go on to find yet another, even larger layer. Money is paid up the pyramid to those above. I think scientists have a valid point when they bemoan the fact that it's socially acceptable in our culture to be utterly ignorant of math, whereas it is a shameful thing to be illiterate. Jennifer Willett. A friend of yours calls you up, excited to talk to you, and requests that you come to a meeting to learn about a life-changing opportunity. They explain that they're running their own business now and that you can too. You are going to make a great deal of money, but the first thing you have to do is go to a meeting. You are apprehensive, but your friend won't take no for an answer. At the meeting, there are a few other people you don't know. The friend who invited you is happy to see you and reassures you that this is going to be great. You're introduced to Tony. Tony will be running the meeting and soon will explain everything. Before long, Tony addresses everyone in the meeting. "Welcome, everyone. I'm glad to see new faces tonight. Take a look around you at everyone in the room, because all of you are going to have your lives changed together tonight. Not long ago, a friend of mine came to me and introduced me to VitaRoot Multivitamin and Meal Replacement. I thought, what the hell is this? But I sat through the meeting. By the end of that meeting, I was sold. I realized that this was an opportunity I've been waiting for. My goal is to show you how smart and easy this business is. I want to show you that all you have to do is work a few hours a week, and you will start making money. You see this check? It's my latest check from VitaRoot. It's for $5,270. This was what I made last month by running meetings just like this one. I'm also my own boss, and I live a zero-stress life now." Interesting, huh? Admit it. A part of you wants to know more. That's because basic psychology is at play here. Tony knows that everyone wants to feel like they're part of something, and everyone wants to have control over their lives, make money, and be happy. All of these things were promised in the first minute of the meeting. Tony's goal is to get you to join the business, which means in one way or another you have to pay. Persuading people to buy the company's vitamins to sell, pay a membership fee, and find new recruits is how Tony and the friend who recruited you make money. On top of that, the person who recruited Tony makes money too, and the person above them. Anyone you recruit, including their recruits, is called your downline. You make money from the multiple levels below you, which is why businesses like this are called multi-level marketing. Some multi-level marketing companies, MLMs, that have their agents sell products to the public are legitimate, well-established businesses. A multi-level marketing business is considered a pyramid scheme if the money a recruit makes comes mostly from the people in their downline, the people they recruit. In a very simple example, you ask four of your friends to give you $50 each. You make a profit of $200. Now each of your friends has to go and find four people to give them $50, at which point they will make a net profit of $150. This pattern keeps going, and as it goes on, the number of people involved increases exponentially. Hence the name pyramid scheme, because the base of the pyramid is wider than the top. Pyramid schemes can be much more complicated than this, but that's the essence. The FTC, Federal Trade Commission, warns the public to look out for three basic signs that you're dealing with a pyramid scheme. Most of your income comes from your recruits, not from direct sales. You're required to buy and maintain product, whether or not you sell it. You may be required to buy other things, like seminars, or pay other fees. Often the products being sold are themselves dubious. They may be services that seem too good to be true. Can you really cut your electricity bill in half? Questionable medical products, or everyday products with extraordinary claims. You can ask yourself, if these products are so good, why aren't they sold in stores? Often, the person trying to recruit you will insist that the company is not a pyramid scheme, and that it is totally legal. It's a safe bet that anytime someone tells you their company isn't a pyramid scheme, it is. Studies involving hundreds of MLMs have shown that 99.6% of people involved actually lose money. Only the people at the very top of the pyramid make any money. Everyone else in the downline serves only as the ultimate source of their profit. MLMs may also be dubious from a marketing perspective. Let's take our supplement example again. The company itself may not make direct claims to consumers that violate regulations by, for example, declaring that the supplement cures a disease. You won't find such an assertion in any official company information. However, in person at MLM recruiting meetings, they do make or imply such claims. The marketers themselves are customers who are purchasing the supplement for their own use. They then try to sell it with their own anecdotes and claims. They're solely responsible for these claims, and the company has a comfortable buffer against the resulting fraud. The next obvious question is, are MLMs legal? Well, yes and no. Pyramid schemes where no product is involved are illegal in most countries. The gray zone is when an actual product is being sold through an MLM model. In some cases, the product is just a shield for what is ultimately a pyramid scheme. In many cases where people do actually sell the product, that is sufficient to render the company technically legal. But again, even if legal, most people will still lose money because they're forced to buy and maintain product. They may be forced to spend money in other ways, and there isn't enough product being sold to keep the pyramid going. Even with a legitimate MLM end product, the ultimate enemy is math. The structure of an MLM is inherently self-defeating. If, for example, the company starts with just 6 people, and each level has to recruit 6 people of their own, in just 12 levels you have over 2 billion people. Even without complete recruitment, you quickly saturate a population. Further, every person you recruit is now a competitor. They may share your social network, and you'll both be recruiting from the same pool. Any business model that depends on an ever-expanding sales force is simply unsustainable. Your best bet is probably just to stay far and away from any MLM. The chances are overwhelming that you'll end up at the bottom of that pyramid. Section 2. Adventures in Skepticism. Now that we've filled your bags with critical thinking gear, let's put those tools to work. Often on the show, we do what we like to call a deep dive on a topic. There is something interesting in the news, or we get a question, and in order to discuss the topic meaningfully, we need to do a fairly thorough examination of all the relevant claims and the evidence. It's easier than ever to do this because of the internet. In this case, the promise of the internet and the web were largely fulfilled. We now have a readily accessible and searchable reservoir of collected human knowledge. In April of 2017, the estimated size of the World Wide Web was 47.5 billion web pages. Of course, much of this is misinformation, cat videos, pornography, and clickbait ads, but there's some useful knowledge tucked in there as well. The really valuable skills today are in knowing how to find information and, more important, how to critically assess what you find. Here is a guide to navigating the jungle of information out there in the digital wilds. What is the source of the information? There is no single unimpeachable source of information. That's right, not even the SGU. Some sources are better than others, however. Academic sites have been found, when checked for quality, to be the most reliable. Other institutions may also be reliable. If accuracy is important to their reputation, there is likely a team of people working on content, some sort of editorial process or peer review, and they don't have an extreme agenda. Group blogs by professionals are also usually good sources of information. They're more credible than individual blogs or web pages, which are highly variable depending on the individual. Commercial sites are generally less trustworthy. The worst sites, however, are extreme ideological sites that exist to promote a specific narrative. Sometimes the goal is to promote a narrative and sell you stuff, as on the infamous medical conspiracy site Natural News. But, as I said, no one site is perfect, so you need to look at a variety of sources. Further, it's important to find out where that source gets its information from, what the primary source is. It's common on the web for sites to reproduce or simply link to other sources of information. That's what the web means. You have to track information back to the original source. Sometimes that original source isn't reliable, even though it is being repeated by mainstream outlets. It's also possible that the original source, which may be a published scientific study or primary journalism, has been misrepresented by secondary sources. At other times, one primary source gets repeated so many times that you may think it is many sources, but all roads lead back to the same primary.